And welcome, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Avi, I've been thinking about the news. And
good, that's our job.
That's our job, yeah. But I've been thinking, you know, more deeply because I realized this year, or 2024, was one of the quietest years in my mind when it comes to Philadelphia police. You know, as far as the number of stories that I've seen in the past few years, because every day it was always something going on. But this year there was a lot of good news, right? The number of homicides, the lowest we've seen in a decade. Shooting incidents down nearly 30% in 2024. Gun robberies down 37%. Violent crime overall down. Even though we've had some major big incidents, the trend is downward. There are still some issues, though. Retail theft is up. Aggravated assaults up. There's a shortage of police officers. But overall, I was like, wow, 2024, right? I don't know. So we decided.
Were you asking for my opinion?
Yeah,
there?
Your thoughts there. I don't know how you felt about the news.
Right?
Yeah.
I hadn't done the thought exercise that you've done. So I'll just cede that ground to you. Go ahead.
All right. So today we're excited because we have the city's top police officer, top cop here. The one and only Philadelphia Police Commissioner Kevin Bethel will be here. He'll be taking your questions. He'll be answering our questions. And our big question to you, our listeners today, is on a scale of 1 to 10, how safe do you feel in the city of Philadelphia? And explain to us why you feel that way. You can call us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. And for our YouTubers who are watching online.
No, give them the right name. They're the Studio Tubers.
Studio Tubers.
What's up, Studio Tubers? Home Fries. What's up?
Tater Tots. You can simply leave your comment or your question in the chat on WHYY's YouTube page. Yeah.
I don't know how this episode's going to go, but I know we will make Studio Tubers catch on. I am making that my mission.
I love it.
And so before we get into all of that, we're going to do a trio of local news stories, as we always do here at Studio 2. And let's start over in New Jersey. Yesterday, Phil Murphy gave his State of the State address. As State of the State addresses go, not a huge one.
Yeah.
Because he is ending his time as governor.
Lame duck, yeah.
Big election coming up in November. We'll see how that goes. But look, he still gets his State of the State. He gets his 2025 to set priorities and work with the legislature. So we monitored for what he talked about, and he talked about a lot of stuff, extending paid family leave, expanding full-day pre-K, talked about how farmland is taxed, which is a scintillating topic. the one that caught our eye was that he announced his support for a new proposal that will direct school districts across New Jersey, and now I'm quoting him here, to adopt policies that ban cell phones from K-12 classrooms and help establish phone-free schools. And this was a line that actually got bipartisan applause. This is an issue that seems to have activated both sides of the aisle. A lot of people coalescing around this idea that cell phones should not be allowed in schools. Smartphones specifically should not be allowed in schools, that they are a distraction. So New Jersey now potentially moving forward with like a blanket statewide ban.
Yeah, so interesting. And we did a whole show on this.
We did.
And, you know, there's strong, like you said, feelings on both sides of the aisle. A lot of people agree. There's been a concerted effort by municipalities all over the country to sort of tackle the use of social media. And where do kids go on social media? On those cell phones. So that's a big thing. Also, I wanted to mention, and you mentioned this was his final State of the State address. He also talked about, one of the things that stood out to me was he talked about dealing with the roadway fatalities in New Jersey. I know that's a problem we've been dealing with in Philadelphia, but I didn't realize that in New Jersey last year there was a 14% increase in roadway fatalities. So they want to make some of the most dangerous intersections less dangerous. They're going to be working on that. And we're going to be talking about this tomorrow, about Democrats forging forward. But one of the things that Governor Murphy said is he would be willing to work with the Trump administration. He's going to the inauguration next week. And so we're going to be talking about that on the show tomorrow about how Democrats move forward in a Trump 2.0 administration.
Yeah. Is it still hashtag resistance or is it something a little more cooperative? Mm-hmm. And we've seen more cooperative signals from Josh Shapiro. here in Pennsylvania. So Phil Murphy, not alone in that. Let's go to Philadelphia now for story number two, Cherry.
Yes.
And you've got the ball.
Yes. Museum Row, you know, along the Ben Franklin Parkway. They'll officially have a new addition this fall when Calder Gardens finally opens.
Calder Gardens. What is it?
Well, if you have no idea what it is, you've probably seen the construction on Ben Franklin Parkway between 21st and 22nd. It's this new exhibition space
that'll be dedicated
to the work of 20th century sculptor Alexander Calder.
Your personal favorite,
it's
right, Cherry?
Gorgeous. Yeah. And it's this wide open space that incorporates art, big exhibition spaces and sanctuary spaces for art. But it's also surrounded by nature. So it's supposed to feel like a very meditative space that you can go in and reflect and feel.
You sound like you're making fun of
me. No, I'm not. I'm
a
meditator. To, you know, reflect and feel like at one with nature and
art. I like
art.
This idea.
I love the idea.
I hope it's as beautiful as it sounds, because I love the idea of like an outdoor sculpture garden. It's art, it's nature.
Yeah.
That does distinguish it somewhat from the other
things on
spaces.
Museum Row.
Yeah.
And by the way, the renderings look really cool. And Calder Springs was supposed to open in 2024, but they had a water main break that they hit during construction, or a water main that they hit and broke open during construction.
Yeah, you don't want to do that.
So that delayed things. And so now it will open in September. But there's lots of movement on the parkway, though, because
lots of movement.
You remember a couple of years ago, the city announced that the African American Museum of Philadelphia would move onto the parkway. They unveiled plans for that in late 2023. The old Family Court building is expected to house an expansion of the Free Library that will include a children and family center and an auditorium. There's also plans for a 250-room hotel right along there. So a lot of stuff is happening there.
Shaking and baking on the parkway.
I like it.
And there's actually a grant announced from the federal government earlier this week that allows them to do some work on traffic calming. So it's a little more pedestrian friendly around there. So maybe you could visit all the different museums, hit them all up and, you know, not feel like you're crossing a roaring highway. Right?
Yeah, because people do like to speed down the parkway as it is now. Yep.
By the way, Alexander Calder's grandfather designed the Billy Penn statue.
Oh.
Top City Hall. There you go.
You know what?
Tidbit.
Can I just take a moment?
That's a pretty well-known tidbit.
But I didn't know that.
Don't give me too much credit. That's pretty well-known.
Okay, there you go.
But I was trying to
give
you're trying to show love, and I appreciate that.
I was.
Let's show some love now to the Puppy Bowl.
Oh.
Do you know the Puppy Bowl? The Puppy Bowl.
I've heard of the Puppy Bowl.
It's an annual event on Super Bowl Sunday that features shelter animals playing their version of football. It's supposed to encourage adoption. It's very, very popular. And up at WHYY.org, you can get a local spin on this year's Puppy Bowl. A dozen area pups will take part in the big game this year, including a dog named Saquon Barkley, a tribute to Eagles star running back Saquon Barkley. And that got us thinking, Cherry.
Okay.
Could we come up with a team of theoretical dogs that are inspired by Eagles players' names?
Mm.
We brainstormed. That's all we did this morning. I mean, we went deep into our bag, Cherry. And now I'm going to introduce to you our Philadelphia Beagles.
Okay.
Okay, you ready?
There you go. He's punning it up.
All right. So obviously at running back, we have Saquon Barkley. At linebacker, instead of Oren Burks, we have Oren Barks.
All right.
At defensive end, instead of Bryce Huff, we have Bryce Ruff. At tight end, instead of Dallas Goedert, we have Dallas Digdirt.
All right. Digdirt.
At tight end, another tight end here. Two tight ends on this team. Instead of Grant Calcaterra, we have Grant Calcaterrier.
All right.
At wide receiver, Jahan Dotson has become Jahan Dachsund. And at safety, we have, instead of Reed Blankenship, Reed Blanken Shih Tzu.
Oh, that's cute. And I love Shih Tzus too.
Yeah.
By the way, we cannot, you know, have a team without a quarterback.
Okay.
And so.
Did you find a pun for Jalen Hurts? Because I could not think of one.
We have Jaland Hurts.
So what's a Jaland?
A Jaland is.
Oh, there it is.
There it is. Adorable. Adorable. It's a hybrid dog, a Japanese chin, and white Highland Terrier mix. So there's Jaland Hurts. Look at that.
Jaland Hurts.
There
Looks
you
like
go.
A really cute and good quarterback. And I will say, in our Legends division, let me add, we have quarterback Donovan McLab.
Ooh.
Cornerback Lito German Shepherd. Defensive end Hugh Pugless.
And Hugh Pugless.
Pugless. And safety Brian Dogkins.
And this is what we do in the morning. You know what I mean? Put it all together. I love it.
Just cancel the show now.
I love it.
This is Studio 2. Coming back, we're going to talk with Philadelphia Police Commissioner Kevin Bethel. Mm-hmm. We want to know from you, scale of 1 to 10, how safe do you feel in Philadelphia? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Philadelphia Police Commissioner Kevin Bethel has been on the job for just a year, and a lot has happened in that time. Some of it is pretty good news.
The city's homicide count continues to trend downward, and 2024 saw the lowest murder rate in a decade. And while gun violence is top of mind for a lot of people when it comes to public safety, there are so many other factors that impact whether or not people feel safe in the city, like dirt bikes and ATVs on the streets, theft and car break-ins, crime on public transit, and an epidemic of opioid addiction.
Commissioner Bethel came in with a long list of changes he wanted to make to the department. And today we're going to do a temperature check. How are things going behind the scenes at PPD? What's working? And what did we learn from some of the high-profile policing incidents of the past year? The commissioner joins us now in studio to answer our questions and yours. Commissioner Kevin Bethel, welcome back to Studio 2.
Oh, no. Well, thank you for having me. I'm always glad to be here. Always.
Wonderful. And to you, our listeners tuning in this hour, on a scale of 1 to 10, how safe do you feel in Philadelphia and why? You can call us 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. And that's the question, Commissioner, that we have to our listeners on a scale of
10
1
and
to
above.
10.
No, we're not taking anything under 10.
You know, and so I wanted to ask you that question. As our chief public safety officer, you know, head of PPD, I want you to zoom out and give us an assessment of how safe you feel the city of Philadelphia is on the scale of 1 to 10, and then roll in some of the things you've done to make it that number.
No, but well, I think, I mean, I realize coming back, you know, to the department, you know, when we look back at we had three of the most challenging years in the history of the city of Philadelphia, 1,600 homicides in 3 years, you know, countless shootings. So I recognize that 1 year is not going to totally change the viewpoint of the city of Philadelphia. But we are making significant strides, as you can see. And that trend started, you know, a couple of years ago, trending down. We know that the people's perception of crime and what they see is far different than the crime we, you know, that happens out in the community. It's actually sometimes two or three times higher. And so we recognize that that is a part of the process, but we are in a really good place. We are trending in a great direction. You know, the mayor came in the beginning of the year, last year, and really set the tone. Safety would be the, you know, really, and that starts the process, right? That tone matters. Mm-hmm. That people know that we as a department are going to be fully focused on that. And so, you know, when I came back, you know, during my previous time of being here for 30 years and then coming back, really focusing on those core areas of the city. We have 20 districts, 10 of them represent almost 77% of all of our violence. And within those areas are specific areas that we're very strategic. And we make sure we deploy effectively, and the men and women, I'm proud of the men and women of the police department for the work they have done, that we can have, we know that works. And then working in partnership with others, you know, whether it be our gang violence intervention team, you know, community groups that are working in those different areas, you know, we all are aligned. I tell people, you know, it feels like it took a while to reset from COVID. You know, I was at the school district, and you know, you covered, you know, the shootings we were having and the number of young people that we were having getting shot, you know. The system, I feel, is really back up and really leaning forward. Our federal partners have been incredible supporters and really focusing on those core areas that we think have issues. And so I think, you know, there's a combination of things that are happening, but really being very strategic, using the data, working in partnership, working in collaboration with others, making sure we're using the technology that we have today. You know, we're using some of the most advanced technologies that we've ever had in the police department, you know, to be able to track down individuals who are engaging in negative behavior in our communities. In addition to the DNA and advancements in the DNA have been significant now.
Yeah.
You know, and so all of those things, each piece is part of a bigger puzzle that's making us, I think, much more effective. And then mm-hmm. I'll end with the clearance rate. You know, last year we ended with a 72% clearance rate in our homicide. That is significant. Mm-hmm. But more,
and just explain clearance rate for those who don't know. That's basically the percentage of those crimes that someone gets charged.
Yeah, someone's getting charged with a homicide. Now, how often cost your officers that's within the year that it's happened? So it could have been an incident from 2 years ago, sure. a year ago. But what's even more, when you couple that with the shooting investigation group, where we now really focus on, we have a team of highly skilled detectives who really focuses on those non-fatal shootings that we all could be, know that they were just a step away from being a fatal shooting.
Yeah.
And the 34%, you know, 37% clearance rate they ended last year with is absolutely significant, because those individuals we know, are those shooters are oftentimes our killers, and they are shooting more than once in many occasions. So being able to get them and get them off the street, I think, has also been an enhancement of our strategy as well.
So it sounds like you give a pretty high number on the 1 to 10 scale.
Yeah, you know, because I'm 61 years old, born and raised in the city, grew up in West Philadelphia. I love this city.
Yeah,
I think it's one of the best cities I've been. I've been all over. This is who I am, and so I'm not that person, you know, who turns shade. I mean, we are safe. We have our issues. Even when we see the violence come down, it's still concentrated in very small micro areas of the city. We've had historical violence. So I'm also cautious that the winds that we describe, also those marginalized and more challenging communities are still suffering with the violence that's happening, maybe at a lower scale. And so we want to continue to drive those now to make it safe for mm-hmm. all of our Philadelphians, not just particular areas.
You mentioned tone setting mm-hmm. and with the mayor. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that she said on the campaign trail when she was running for mayor is that she would not rule out the use of what she called constitutional stop and frisk. Well, now you've been on the job for a year, and from the numbers that we've seen, stops really haven't changed at all from their prior levels. So right. was that just tone setting, sort of her saying we're going to be tough and that you never really planned to do more of it? Or like, what is your philosophy around stops and stop and frisk?
Well, listen, I don't want to speak for the mayor directly. I don't think she was, you know, just saying it to be saying. I think what, you know, the conversations that were coming out throughout the campaign was, you know, what are you going to do around, you know, the violence in the community? A lot of folks were asking those questions. The mayor, you know, rightfully so, shifted and said, you know, you as an attorney, you know, Terry versus Ohio, right? It wasn't about, you know, a stop and frisk. It is a legal standard that is required for you to do that. And never in that conversation did the mayor say, Kevin, you're going to go out there and make 200,000 stops because yeah. I say it.
Numbers did used to be a lot higher, but I think
what folks have to understand, we've been under a federal consent decree for quite some mm-hmm. time. I meet with a federal judge, you know, on a quarterly basis to go through, you know, where we are with our stops. How are, you know, they, are we doing them effectively? Are we within the constructs of the legal standard to be able to do that? That has been there with us from quite some time. And so what we do know that it's part of policing, though, right? But as I share with you, policing has become a lot more strategic because we know that using the data tells the who, what, when, where, and why, being very focused. You know, when I came on the job in 1986, you know, it was, these rules of engagement were not there, right? Mm. You go out, you stop people, you know.
Yeah.
And so we become much more refined, both nationally, but here in the city of Philadelphia, to say, you know, what is it? Is it a mirror encounter? Is it a pedestrian stop? We're using a lot of very strategic tools now to be able to accomplish the things we need to do. We're recovering just as many guns as we have year over year. And so we think we have a very effective strategy. A pet stop is a part of that strategy. So those who say you just shouldn't do it at all, or a Terry versus Ohio stop, a Terry stop, that is a legal standard. So resetting the norms, that it is okay to do a Terry stop. Mm-hmm. If you have reasonable suspicion of probable cause, we are going to stick to that. But we're not also pushing to say go out there and stop people just because. We know we legally cannot do that. And so we're going to continue to work hard. But we're able to accomplish our goals, but making sure that that's still on in our playbook as we go about doing our work.
Yeah, and we want to welcome you into the conversation. On a scale of 1 to 10, how safe do you feel in the city of Philadelphia, and why? If you have questions for Commissioner Bethel, please give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. In May of this year, the city cleared out encampments in the Kensington neighborhood. I want to take a listen to this clip from Markia. She's a resident of that neighborhood, and we spoke to her yesterday. Take a listen to what she had to say.
With them taking all the attics off of the avenue, all they did was go on the corner, turn the corner, and sit right there on the side. So we didn't clean it up. We actually made it worse. Mm-hmm. So now we come outside, they sleep in front of our doors. Or I can't leave my kids' bikes in the yard now because they're walking there and not locked. Whereas though they used to stay down there, leave them where they at. If you're not going to take them off the street, don't push them in our where we live in. You took them from in front of the businesses and basically said, F the community, F the people in the community that supports the businesses. So, no, I don't think he did good. I think he just made it worse.
And so, as you can hear, some people not mm-hmm. very happy about how the Kensington cleanup happened. The whole encampment cleanup was very controversial. I just want you to kind of go through, like, what did the PPD learn from those efforts in Kensington? And how do you feel like things, the end result was?
Well, I don't know if it's not an end or a beginning, right? It's been ongoing, so I won't put it as a bookends. I mean, you know, the encampment process was happening over several years where, you know, the legal standard to notify individuals that they could not set up an encampment on Kensington Avenue. It wasn't controversial. Unfortunately, their timing was off, and so mm-hmm. things moved ahead of the policing, and so that caused some early disruption in that encampment. We did subsequent encampments under 95, which went very successfully with no problems. That has been the process that was set up. We clearly understand. I think sometimes it is managing expectations. You know, I was in narcotics in 1991, and guess what? Folks lived down on the tracks. And people just turned an eye to that, and you knew they were down there. 150, 200 yeah. people lived down there, and there was a decision, you know, and that was decades and decades ago. So this problem has been there, and then obviously there was a decision to move folks off the track and bring them up onto the street level, and so we've always been dealing with that, mm-hmm. and so the expectation that yes, you know, the mayor puts forth when I came on, that was one of my first charges we give me. I deployed another 75 men and women down into the area in June. And so we've been at it for around 6 months now. The expectation that we're going to take one of the most challenging areas in America. You know, we have folks that are not addicted to heroin, but addicted to fentanyl and xylazine and other things. The conditions that we're seeing down there are significant. The efforts are going to have to be continue to go through this process, a methodical process. You know, the wellness center that the mayor announced the other day to be able to move people into long-term care, a wellness court that will be putting down there to deal with some of the issues. And so we're working very methodically through the process. We know there's been a lot of frustration down in the community, and it's going to take time to be able to take back that area.
Do you think in the first 6 months, though, you've done anything more than just move people around?
You can find for every citizen you find the negative, I'll bring you in folks who find the positive, right? I mean, you know, we have been working hard to keep folks off the corner. There's an expectation that people believe that I can just walk up somebody and just violate their rights and just take them away. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I can't do that, right? And so we have to make sure people understand it. I don't have the legal authority just to grab someone off the street, nor do I have the legal authority to force them into treatment, right? And so there is some the parts of this process that we have to go through to get to the place where we need, you know, and continually move today. You can't, you know, fires. Yeah. We're used to burn, you know, we have a fire brigade working with our fire department to address those issues. So it's getting better, mm-hmm. But it's not happening as fast as some people want it to.
Yeah.
And that's the challenge that we face.
But what do you say to someone like Markia who right. lives in that community and says, look, we were dealing with this, but it wasn't necessarily on my front porch, but now it is. What do you say to
them? Well, listen, I think that anyone who's seeing that type of behavior should be calling 911 because my men and women will come and they should not be obstructing the front of someone's door or someone's house. And, you know what I mean? And so we know that there's displacement. We know that people have moved into different areas of that space down there. We're working with our strategy to able to address that. But I hear the frustration.
Yeah.
Right. But there's no intention. You know, I think there's a lot more going on, and we have the tools of down in the area now. There is a learning process, you know. I mean, even from me, hey, I put officers down there, we can clean it up. Ooh. You know, you have to take a reset, right? Because you realize how deep seated this issue of addiction is down in that area. And what people also don't forget is that that was before that. That was one of the most highest drug areas in the city of Philadelphia for drug sales. So we allowed an open air drug market sit on mm-hmm. top of mm-hmm. yeah. already an addiction issue sit on top of that. And so we try to unpack all that. There is some underlying motivation yeah. for those who sell down there to continue those sales.
Yeah. And on that note, let me bring in a caller. This is Tom from Philadelphia, mm-hmm. who I believe has a question about drug dealers in the Kensington area. Tom, you're on Studio 2. What is your question?
My question, Commissioner, hello.
How are you, Tom?
Are you able to arrest the dealers, the street dealers? And if you are they being kept off the street, or is the court system simply a revolving door?
Well, there's a question from Tom in
fair
Philadelphia.
Yeah, it's a fair question. I mean, we have been working with our federal partners, our state partners, Attorney General's office, our team, to arrest those individuals selling. There are a number of them are just staying in custody, but just like anything else, with the number of narcotics arrests we make on a yearly basis, particularly the buyers, oftentimes they are being, you know, moving back out the system. But so we're really continuing to effectively reevaluate our strategy. I worked in narcotics for 15 years. Every door of arrests have always been a revolving door in many cases because of just the sheer number of offenses you hire. But we are working effectively down there. We are bringing in some new tools. Right now, we're piloting a drone project down in Kensington. We met with the community down there.
Say drone project?
Drone, yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
So we're expanding. You know, we're introducing drones into our operations as a department. Yeah. We think drones would be the next a layer of a force multiplier for us in our policing work. There'll be a responder model. We believe that once we get our drone operation fully operational, we can have a drone on location for any priority one or priority two job with less than 2 minutes.
Is that for evidence gathering? What would
so there's going to be situational awareness. It's going to be for, you know, for an officer's out there providing cover for them. They're going to be as 911 responders to be on location. The drone could be on location far before a police officer is on location, be able mm-hmm. to do the observations of what they're seeing. We believe that that strategy will help us in Kensington as we start to focus on the open air drug market down in Kensington. We believe that as part of our strategy, in addition to all of the other things that we're going to use it for, that we'll be able to use our drone strategy to be able to also to address the open air drug markets both here and potentially, as the model continues to evolve, citywide, yeah. Using that that technology. Now, we have cameras stationed across all of our places, but enabled to move a camera into a mobile way
yeah.
is going to be an effective strategy for us.
Can I ask you just about drones in mm-hmm. general? Mm-hmm. I mean, how much has your budget grown for drone usage, you know, over the years? I know you weren't at the department for a bit of time there, but like, can you give us a sense of the scale of drone usage at PPD compared to 5-10 years ago? And also where mm-hmm. you see it trending, because that you talked about mm-hmm. tools for the future. Mm-hmm. That's one that I had imagined is going to come up.
Oh yes, yeah, it's absolutely. I mean, we're very methodical in that process. I started that work when I was at the school district. We started mm-hmm. to buy drones for our super sites when we're having issues at our super sites and be able to launch a drone. Had a drone program at John Bartram High School. Brought that, you know, to the police department when I arrived in January. We did have some modicum use of drones, but more in our special operations.
Yeah.
And now moving it into a more expanded model to be able to use it as a deployment strategy.
Can you give us a sense of scale? Like how many drones might the department have? Well, we're
walking through that process mm-hmm. now. We're in a beta kind of testing model of it now.
Yeah.
Our vision that we would have key areas of the city where we would have the ability to deploy drones. Wow. Across the city as part of our first responder model. A call would come in to 911, man or woman with a gun. The drone will deploy and be on location. You know, I mean, a drone could be 5 blocks away, but be already on location because of the sheer power of the camera.
Wow.
That situational awareness also believe that will help us minimize some of the negative encounters that we may have mm-hmm. as well as we encounter someone with a gun having that drone being on those station on station maybe helps also to minimize some of those.
So they kind of have a better idea of what's happening before they even
absolutely,
arrive.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. And so we think it's a great tool for us to maximize our resources to be able to respond respectively. And so we're continuing to build the, as you say, budget. The city council approved the budget numbers for us to start our drone program. I'm grateful to our team to be able to do that, to be able to bring in the funds. Yeah. We have a foundation, our police foundation helped us as well to buy drones. So we're in that process now.
Yeah. Interesting. And I want to invite you, our listeners, into the conversation. On a scale of 1 to 10, how safe do you feel in the city of Philadelphia and why? And if you have questions for Commissioner Bethel, please call us 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. For our Studio Tubers online, you can leave a comment in the chat.
There's a good one there, right there, in the YouTube chat.
And I want to... April comments, I feel safe when I'm not outside, but I don't feel safe traveling throughout the city. I still have school age kids and I pray daily for their safety. I want to bring in Mike from Upper Darby. He wants to talk about SEPTA and safety. Mike, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, thanks to the commissioner for joining the program. As a resident of Upper Darby, a neighboring community of Philadelphia, I enjoy the benefits of Philadelphia by riding SEPTA into the city to a variety of venues and things. And I know the transit police, I don't think it's under the direct control of the commissioner, but the feeling of safety on SEPTA is something that can affect the vibrancy of the city itself. And I wonder if the commissioner could talk about how he works with SEPTA in order to make lines like the Market L feel a little bit safer, a little bit more policed, a little bit calmer than they might be now.
Thank you so much, Mike, for that question, Commissioner.
Interesting question. Yeah, I mean, we've had historically a great relationship with the SEPTA. Chief Lawson is there now, and my team work with them on a constant basis. As you know, they probably have one of the best video camera systems that you could imagine in a subway system. Oftentimes, we're sharing incidents that are happening in their space with us so we can move that. But we also have to recognize they have a lot of mileage to cover. SEPTA, I think sometimes people think SEPTA is just relegated to Philadelphia. And when they go far outside of our area of the city of Philadelphia. So we work with them most recently. We met with some of the union team to start to do more SEPTA checks that I did when I came on the job almost 40 years ago. We get on the bus, let them be seen, check on folks. So we've been starting to increase that type of activity. Now, people may think that's a small scale, but for some people, we'll see an officer get on the bus and say, oh, well, at least we know they're watching. But it has been challenging, just like anything else. They're underground. They're above ground. Many of our areas intersect where we have these choke points and where, SEPTA folks are moving through Olney Station, Frankfurt Station. We can go down the list. And so we're always collaborating to address the issues that we have. But we have a phenomenal relationship with SEPTA. We continue that relationship. And we understand the challenges they have as well as the challenge we have in protecting the city as people move through on SEPTA.
I want to read an email now that we can maybe cue this your answer up for the other side of the break, because we're getting close to the break here. But this is an interesting email from Valerie, who says, in general, I feel safe in Philadelphia, but whenever I cross the street, I feel that I take my life in my hands. Philadelphia drivers do not yield to pedestrians in crosswalks. Why is there so little enforcement of driving rules? But I will note one thing that came out in an Inquirer article recently is that traffic enforcement and stops actually is way up. That's one of the few things that's really is up over the last year. So I would love to hear your thoughts on that, whether that is about traffic safety, whether it's about enforcement of other rules, because there's lots of reasons for a potential traffic stop, right? So we're going to cue that up, that question from Valerie on the other side of the break. But we'd love to hear from you out there. How safe do you feel in Philadelphia on a scale of 1 to 10? Mookie on YouTube says, on a scale of 1 to 10, if you mind your business, it's a 7. If you don't mind your business, it's a 3.
All right. Mind your business.
Yeah, like words of wisdom from Mookie on YouTube. So you can comment on the YouTube stream. You can email studio2@whyy.org, or you can call 888-477-9499. Lots more to come with Commissioner Kevin Bethel on the other side of this break. You're listening to Studio 2. Thank you.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Joining us in the studio right now is Philadelphia Police Commissioner Kevin Bethel. We've been talking about his first year on the job, which continued to show a downward trend in homicides, as well as some issues that made big headlines.
Of course, we're taking your questions this hour. And our question for you today, on a scale of 1 to 10, how safe do you feel in the city? You can also just ask some questions directly to the commissioner if you'd like. 888-477-9499, studio 2 at WHYY.org. And our studio tubers can leave a comment on the YouTube stream.
Yeah, and we left off with this comment, this email from Valerie, who says, again, for you, I feel generally safe in Philadelphia, but whenever I cross the street, I feel like I take my life in my hands. And her question is, why is there so little enforcement of driving rules? Can you talk about that? And I know there has been an increase in the number of car stops.
Yeah, we really took a hard look when I returned, you know, really focusing on our traffic enforcement, recognizing, you know, there is clear data that shows that when you have good traffic enforcement, you can reduce the level of accidents and particularly pedestrian accidents in that process. And so we have been very strategic and been very mindful of increasing those numbers. Been very targeted, hitting Broad Street and hitting, you know, going to the certain corridors. You know, people don't realize they, you know, when they put cameras on the boulevard, then people found that, well, we're going to find alternate routes. Now we're going to go into the side streets.
Yeah.
You know, and so some of that activity. So, you know, really proud of the men and women we put forth a charge to all of our commanders and being very strategic as to going after these individuals that are, you know, just disregarding, you know, getting back to the norms. Mm-hmm. The reason you would sit at 3 o'clock at a light, at a red light, is because you thought a cop was going to be there to stop you.
Yeah.
You know, and we started to get those norms starting to erode is when you start to see this level of recklessness and folks just think that they can drive any way they are. And so my challenge to the team was, let's get back to the work that we do. And that creates challenges because my staffing is down. So we also have to be very mindful that when I am down with staffing, it takes two officers to do a car stop. And we make prioritization of going to our 911 calls. So someone's calling for help, you know, we're always going to go to do that kind of that work before we would still, you know, effectively going after cars.
When and you're so, triaging, you have to do that.
Yeah. And so part of our first priority is being, you know, responding to those calls of service, those 911 calls where people are calling for help. And so we're balancing that work. And that's why we've been really being deploying in a very strategic way to go out there and do those stops. Go into those areas where we're getting complaints from the community. And that's a process that we're going through. That process will continue to build. You know, I mean, to get back to resetting the norms that you just can't drive around the city any way you want without any penalties.
So staffing's a big hurdle there. And it, you said staffing's down.
Yes, staffing's down.
Even though we've heard a lot about recruitment efforts, attempts to fill the vacancies that have been there. So first of all, what's the latest data on staffing? And what are the big challenges to getting folks to sign up?
Yeah, I mean, so we've cleared some hurdles. I'll take your last part first. Yeah, I'm really proud of our city OHR, my OHR, my department, and others within our background and team. We really have set a very good template now, you know, to be able to bring individuals on. And we've been able to get over some of the hurdles. You've heard testing, you know, taking the reading tests and the physical fitness tests, you know, the efforts that were put by the mayor prior to arriving and then others who took that on board has really helped us getting our recruitment and getting numbers in. Unfortunately, we're in a place now, we have a drop that allows individuals to go in and retire, you know, after 4 years. And so, you know, unfortunately, after the riots and the things that happened over the last 4 years, many of the men and women made the decision that they wanted to leave. And so we are in a kind of a challenging period right now as we continue to bring individuals on. We still have a number of men and women who are retiring from the department. And so we are working hard to increase our recruitment numbers. We're doing well in recruitment and getting individuals every 6 weeks. We're getting about 40 officers in every 6 weeks. That is a good.
That's higher.
Yeah, that's high. Last year, we had the highest number of recruit for a year coming in pre-COVID.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we are turning the curve But we still have a lot of work to do
Of the rate of retirement.
Because of the rate of retirement.
And let's talk about that. What has been the feedback? I mean, I know we had a tough 4 years just dealing with policing, dealing with all the COVID and all the crime that we were dealing with in the city of Philadelphia. But what are you hearing from officers? Because I've talked to some and some said they didn't necessarily feel supported and that's why they weren't willing to stay. What are you hearing and what are you doing to sort of retain those officers? Because you can't just have all young officers on the street.
Well, listen, I mean, well, that's part of it, right? Our new kids always go to the street. And so that's always as part of it. But I think I appreciate the question because I tell people, you know, part of my work the last year was really building morale in the department. And, you know, because, you know, part of for the last 4 years, I mean, the police department went through one of the most challenging times in American history. Right. And they have the defunding and the feeling that, you know, you're not valued and feeling demoralized. And again, I don't come here telling you we don't have our issues.
Yeah.
Right. But the majority, 99% of my men and women come to work to serve every day. And so part of my work has been to rebuild them now. The mayor talks positively about our men and women. Right. She has no tolerance for inappropriate behavior. But, you know, we know that policing is a very critical part of the infrastructure of this city and how this city will get safer. And so we're not going to, I mean, so part of the work is really building them out, talking about them, elevating the work that they're doing, being supporters of them, holding them accountable. But at the same time, you know, policing is here and it's part of who we are. And so what I am most proud of is their resilience, you know, coming even despite it all. Despite losing men and women during COVID, when many people obviously had to retreat, the police department lost cops and lost individuals who died from COVID, you know, because they continue to come serve, right? And so part of that is really recognizing who they are, the qualities they have, and being very public about that. It'll take time, as you know, in all of that, to get the men and women. But I think we're in a better place. Most recently, we put out a call for folks to stay for, again, another year, and we extended our drop. We had the largest number of men and women to do that. That's a good indication that they're feeling better about the department, and so we'll continue to do that work.
Well, look, some folks certainly have positive perspectives, including Mia on YouTube. We asked that 1 to 10 question. Mia says, I rated a 9. I have wonderful neighbors on a close-knit block. They make all the difference. And obviously, there has been some good news this year. We want to give you a chance to talk about that. We haven't really yet. The homicide rate, way down. Mm-hmm. You know, it has not been this low since 2014.
Who was here in 2014?
I was. You were here. You were all here.
You were part of the department then. Mm-hmm. How do you explain the drop? Look, it's been across the country. Let's not just imagine that it's just Philadelphia. Right. But how do you explain it, and what can you continue to do to sort of keep that pace?
Listen, it's pieces of it, right? And I think I shared that earlier in the conversation. It's 560 plus homicides. We're the highest number ever in the city of Philadelphia. And so we had to know, and we do know, that there was going to be this regression back to your core numbers, right? We could see that happening. And that's the trend often you're seeing across America, that the cities that rose during COVID are all coming back to their baseline. But our job at the time was knowing that, is to get behind it and push it.
Yeah, get lower.
Yeah. I mean, you don't sit there and say, oh, okay, whatever's going to land, it'll land, everybody be happy with 350 homicides. What is the number?
Yeah.
Like, what is the number that folks are going to be satisfied? It's a tragedy that we use death as a measure for success in our city, but that's the reality of it, right?
If homicides
go up, the city's terrible. If it goes down, it's getting better. Okay. But so what we did when I came back to the department is really drive the department. I don't care what the trend is. Let's push. There's no brake pad. You know, if we're going to meet the charge of the mayor to make this the safest city in America, if I'm going to meet my charge to make this the best police department in America, then let's get to work. And so part of the push is to really push the men and women to be very focused, be very data-driven. See, I mean, you know, so we have 10 districts that come in every 2 weeks. Every 2 weeks, those captains are coming in talking about their strategy, what are the shifts they're making, what are the deployment decisions they're making, and being very strategic. But I think also other things come into play in that as well, right? We have our group violence intervention team meeting with Deion Sumter and sit down and say, listen, when you're strategizing where you're going to go, here's the key areas that I need you to go. I mean, I don't need you to be in areas where I don't see the level of violence. If we're going to be violence driven, then those people who want to say they're part of the process have to be in those areas where the violence is.
Yeah.
You know, and so making sure I met with all of our federal partners and asked them to align with their work. And then there's a lot of money being put out in the community for community services and folks working with young people and working with different groups. I think all of it, I mean, if this is going to take some time to kind of unpack all of it.
Yeah, disentangle.
But what I do know is that the police department, it does has a major role because we're in there 365 days a year, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day in those most, you know, difficult areas in the community, going after these individuals who are causing harm. Right. That I do know, and that I do know is having an impact on those numbers coming down.
And by the way, we got an email from Janet who says, shouldn't you acknowledge the death of the senior class student who was killed recently? And she's talking about that student who was shot on the way to Fells High School. I believe that was yesterday.
Right.
And that was a tragic incident. And so we talked about one death.
I didn't acknowledge it here, but we didn't have a conversation around that. I mean, part of what we do know when we look at these, as you know, coming from the school district, I dealt with a number. Now, Fells is afar from where he got shot near in his home, in the rear of his home. So even though he's leaving out for school, so he wasn't near his school, but we dealt with those issues of our let outs and the kids being killed, Roxborough and different schools where we had kids killed outside of the school. We're looking at this case and seeing where it's going, whether this was clearly it was targeted.
Yeah.
You know, was that in retaliation for what? We don't, you know what I mean? And we're walking through that process now to see what was the root cause behind that
early
shooting.
Early stages of that, for sure.
Yeah, and since we're talking about young people, we got to acknowledge that while gun violence is down in the city compared to the pandemic highs, some people are really worried about the younger folks. And we mentioned that 17-year-old student who was gunned down in North Philly. And here is Dana, who spoke with our producer, Andreas, at the Tioga SEPTA station in Kensington yesterday. She has that concern. Take a listen.
I do feel like younger kids these days, especially like teenagers, like 14-year-olds having guns is crazy to me. I feel like that's something that should be high priority for the commissioner to try and get like a hold of for kids' safety, for anyone's safety regardless, but definitely for kids' safety.
And so I want to give you an opportunity to address that, because on one end you have young people with guns, and on the other end, the PPD recently announced that they're now going to stop arresting kids for low-level crime and putting them in diversion programs. Right. Could you talk about, there's a wide range there, but could you address this issue with juveniles?
Yeah, so first and foremost, I mean, we're talking about this year, we're up a little bit, about 12% of all of our air violences were associated with juveniles. So that leaves you 88% of the majority of it is 18 and over. So I think we have to kind of sometimes reset people that our juveniles are not the majority, even though sometimes
the massive,
they get.
Yeah.
Sometimes it can feel that way.
Yeah, absolutely. But coming through COVID, I mean, there was a lot of money on the street, and a lot of young people who never had access to guns were getting guns, right? We've seen a large number of young people with guns. Yeah, I mean, you know, I remember being at school, and a kid comes into school, he's got like a $1,300, $1,400 gun. Right. And so we have been working hard to address it. And those kids are arrested. They do go into the system for the courts to work with them. But we can do both. You know, you cover me. You were the first person who covered me, Sherry, when I did my diversion. You came into my office and I had a young lady there with a mom. And you remember that story.
I
still remember that. And I'm so appreciative of you doing that. And so this was an extension of the work that I did with the schools. Locking up children for minor offenses, this young girl on a bus, and we put her in custody. We would move those to a diversionary model to be able to get to the root issue of what was going on with her. And so that model is effective model for us. We have to be officers who also have the empathy. I got a young kid who's 10 years old who just stole something from a store. I do not and will not put that child in custody, cuff him, put him in a cell block for 6 hours to get the courts to try to figure out what's wrong with him or what's going on. I want him to go into community-based services, with services we continue to use with the school district. Appreciate DHS, Department of Human Services. They provide the programs to get to the why. That kid's trajectory can take off into a whole different place to get to that. So we're talking about low-level offenses. In 1986, I got a kid, I dust him off and let him go. Get out of here.
Yeah,
we took that away from our men and women. And now we're giving them something back that they had historically to be able to make different decisions around young people.
You mentioned 1986 when you joined the force. And just as we wrap up, 85, we're coming up on the 40th anniversary of 85, the MOVE bombing. Mm-hmm. And you entered this profession just after that landmark moment in Philadelphia policing. I'm curious how that incident was talked about within the department as you came up through the ranks and how it's changed over the years and your reflections on it as we approach that 40th anniversary.
Well, so I lived not too far from Osage. I could see the smoke and the billowing of smoke and watching on TV like others. It wasn't talked much when I came in. By the time I came into the job, policing is changing. We're moving to this, love them, hug them, mini stations, mobile mini stations. We're going through this paradigm shift of trying to move into community policing. We struggled with it, and we've struggled for decades.
Yeah.
But there was a definite shift of moving away from the old style of policing to a much more newer style of community-based policing. And the conversation, even decades, four decades later, still continues. Yeah. And so we it's not policing the community, it's community policing.
Yeah.
And so we're about to embark on a strategic plan, to 5-year strategic plan, to really encapsulate, what does the community want from us? How they want us to be effective in this space? Every community is different. And I think through that strategic plan, I think we can set ourselves on a different track.
Well, I look forward to seeing that plan.
Absolutely.
And I got to just jam this in there. If you, there were one thing you need for the PPD to do your job better, what would that be?
I just need the community to give us that opportunity to continue to serve them, to continue to acknowledge the men and women, the work they're doing. That support is critical because that resets the norms for us moving forward. And I'm just appreciative of you allowing me to be on the show to talk about the work we're doing.
And we appreciate the time. You're welcome back, of course, in a year from now or sooner, if you prefer, Philadelphia Commissioner Kevin Bethel. Thanks for the time today on Studio 2.
I appreciate you both.
Yes, and thank you to all the folks who emailed in, who commented on YouTube and on Facebook. And thank you to our producers, Debbie Bilder, Paige Murray-Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Paul Parmalee engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Thanks for joining us, and we will talk to you tomorrow. We'll